Well, hello there, my friends. Welcome back. My name is Stephanie Safarian, and you're listening to episode 464 of Sustainable Minimalists. This is a listener-supported show about intentional and eco-friendly minimalist living. On today's show, we're discussing all things pesticides, and specifically the pesticides that are frequently found on our fruits and vegetables. We're discussing, yes, of course, what they are and why they're used, but our conversation today is so much more than that. Today, I am attempting to do something bold, and that is to provide you with the most comprehensive information with regard to what's happening right now when it comes to pesticides on our produce. Now, there are countless different pesticides. I believe there's over 1,000, and each one comes with a different risk profile. Today, I am going to do my absolute darndest to arm you with the knowledge you need so that you can buy produce like a conscious and informed consumer who, of course, is informed based on the most up-to-date research. Now, first off, my sincere apologies for the delay in getting this episode out into the world. I teased it for many weeks and then delay after delay occurred. I'll spare you the details, but I'll just say that it's really important for me to cover this topic and all topics, frankly, from every angle. And again, using the most recent scientific data, I delayed the episode so that I could most accurately serve you. And here I am now putting this episode out into the world, and I must say I am quite proud of it. Speaking of, there is an extended version of this episode for supporters of the show. And in the extended portion, I am outlining 6 very specific action steps for you when you buy fruits and vegetables. Perhaps you, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, you use the free trial option to listen to the extended version of today's show. And perhaps if you get benefit, you continue on after the 3-day free trial and support the show. Thank you so much for considering supporting my hard work. And it is hard work, I must say. So today's show is really a 2-part show. In the first part of today's show, we're discussing just me and you. We're having a little chat about everything you need to know about pesticides. After the break, part 2 is a conversation with Dr. James Rogers. He's an old veteran, an old pro of this show. He and his team over at Consumer Reports just completed the most comprehensive analysis of pesticides in our food supply. I'm asking him some very specific questions about different pesticides, their risk profiles, and what we should be doing and buying at the grocery store. That's part 2. And so fruits and vegetables, yes, they are an irreplaceable part of a healthy diet, no question about it. But despite the benefits of fresh produce, fruits and vegetables have also been long known to expose us to potentially harmful chemicals. And that's because many farmers around the world rely on synthetic chemicals in the form of pesticides in food production. I mentioned there are over 1,000 pesticides that are used around the world, and synthetic pesticides, which are, of course, the man-made chemicals made in a lab, they are specifically designed to kill or repel pests like insects. We've got the insecticides. Or fungus, we've got the fungicides, you get the picture. All these different types of pesticides protect crops, increase crop yields, and may even increase the number of times each year a crop can be grown on the same land. Now, in countries with food shortages, pesticides could perhaps be considered quite helpful. But in other areas of the world, like here in the United States, the argument can certainly be made, heck, I'm making it, that pesticides are widely overused and they're overused for the wrong reasons. More than 1 billion pounds of pesticides are used each year in the United States alone. That's billion with a B, my friends. Worldwide, farmers spend nearly $60 billion annually on buying pesticides. So pesticides increase crop yield. Yes, that is true. But pesticides also damage the environment. We will get to that in a bit. Let's get into the human health risks first. They are synthetic chemicals made to kill organisms. Kill organisms. Is your spidey sense going off? It should be going off. Pesticides are intrinsically toxic. If they're made to kill or repel stuff, they're likely not good for us either. Humans can have both acute and chronic health effects from persistent pesticide exposure. Long-term exposure to pesticides has been linked to various types of cancer, to asthma, to neurological diseases like Parkinson's disease, to anxiety and depression, to ADHD, to developmental delays in children, to reproductive issues and even infertility in women. So pesticides, my friends, take home message number one, pesticides are not benign. Just because they're on our food doesn't mean they're healthy. If you have children, or if you are pregnant or hoping to get pregnant, or if you are immunocompromised, you especially listen up because sensitive populations are always more susceptible to deleterious health effects. Studies do find that the highest amounts of pesticides in some of the most popular foods that our children eat, like berries, I'll talk about that with Dr. Rogers in part two of our conversation, like apples, the highest amounts of pesticides in the entire food supply are often found in our children's favorite fruits. Pesticides have also been found in breast milk, in umbilical cord blood. What does that mean? It means that exposures to pesticides start before birth and continue through infancy and beyond. And so I mentioned before, too, it's the persistent exposure to pesticides that's the problem. It's very rare for you to eat, let's just say, a pepper with a pesticide on it and then immediately get sick. That almost never happens. It's the persistent exposure over your lifetime to these synthetic chemicals that presents the problem. Now, research from Harvard shows that consuming fruits and vegetables with high levels of pesticide residues may lessen the benefits of fruit and vegetable consumption. So what does that mean? That means if we're eating fruits and vegetables for their health benefits, eating these items when they're doused in pesticides may indeed take away some or most of these benefits. Now, I did mention earlier that different pesticides have different risk profiles. And that, again, is another take-home message I want you to understand today. Before researching for this episode, I tended to be very black and white in my purchasing of produce. When I went to the supermarket, I would look for organic or not organic, good or bad, right or wrong choice. I mean, I am a dualistic thinker in general, but this way of shopping is too simplistic. The toxicity of a pesticide depends on its function. Insecticides do tend to be more toxic to humans than herbicides. The same chemical can have different effects in different doses. Toxicity can also depend on the route by which the exposure occurs. So swallowing or inhaling or just having direct contact with the skin, these are all different ways in which you can have exposure to pesticides. Now, the presence of so many different pesticides in foods is also problematic because there's very little data available about how multiple pesticides interact with each other in the body, or how such mixtures could compound each chemical's individual potential health harms. So there's very little data with regard to how the pesticide phosmet interacts with the pesticide oxamil, let's say. There's very little, if any, heck, I'm not aware of any data with regard to how that pesticide phosmet interacts with the triclosan or the phthalate from your personal care products in your body. All these chemicals are accumulating in our bodies, and there's no research to say how they interact with each other. We'll get to that in part three of our show today. I have some thoughts there. The little data that we do have does suggest that when multiple pesticides are present, they may be more toxic to humans at lower levels than when they are present alone. So if I asked you to name as many pesticides as you could, I just gave you a couple. I just gave you phosmet and oxmil. But those two aside, if I asked you to name a pesticide, could you do it? I'll give you a second to think. Name a pesticide. All right, time's up. I'm guessing there is one pesticide that most of you can name. And that, of course, is the infamous DDT. DDT, also known as dichlorotrichloroethane. Whew, I did pretty good there. DDT was for many years the most widely used pesticide in the United States. After World War II, DDT was promoted and advertised as a wonder chemical. It was advertised as the super simple and affordable solution to all your pest problems, the big pest problems, the small pest problems, and everything in between. DDT was loved, again, because it was cheap, it was affordable, it was effective, it was versatile, and it persisted. We'll talk about the persistence problem in a minute. But during the glory days of DDT, over 1.3 billion pounds of DDT was used here in the United States. Now, you may know something about DDT. You may know that it is banned worldwide. Here in the United States, it was author Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson wrote one of the leading environmental books, Silent Spring, in 1962. Silent Spring came out. But anyway, it was author Rachel Carson who first alerted the public to the many problems associated with DDT, and particularly the big problem being its environmental persistence. It doesn't disappear. It sticks around. Rachel Carson was called a hysterical woman who was making something out of nothing. She was outright mocked and made fun of. But Rachel Carson did know what she was talking about. The science did not know this then, but now we do know that DDT, even at low levels of exposure, can provide oversized harm. I'm talking breast cancer and other cancers. I'm talking male infertility. I'm talking miscarriages and low birth weight, developmental delays in children, nervous system damage, liver damage. These are not small health effects by any means. So yes, nobody knew any of that then, but even so, the use of DDT did decline in the 60s and 70s, and that's because increased insect resistance. So the pesticide no longer worked as it once did. It was no longer the wonder cure that it once was. Insects developed resistance to it. There was also growing, slow to grow, but growing public concern over the adverse effects of DDT. As a side note here, our beloved national bird, the bald eagle, right? The bald eagle was in trouble. And evidence did link DDT with severe declines in bald eagle populations. Their eggshells were thinning. This alarmed Americans because, oh my gosh, it's our beloved bird. And I must say, tier two, that since DDT was banned in the United States, bald eagles have made a dramatic recovery. It did take another 10 years. So 1962, we're talking Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. In the early 70s, the EPA did finally ban DDT here in the United States. In 2001, DDT was banned in almost all situations worldwide at the Stockholm Convention. You may be wondering, well, if DDT is by nature persistent, is there still DDT present in the environment? And the answer is yes. So all those health effects I just read out, I just listed, cancer, male infertility, miscarriages, developmental delays, all of it. Yes, because of DDT's persistence, residues of concern from historical use, so from use back post-World War II, today we can and should still be concerned with those health effects because the DDT that was used over 60 years ago is still around today. DDT and other pesticides, they're like vampires, aren't they? You can't kill them, and they continue to haunt you for decades and decades and decades. Now, DDT aside, synthetic pesticides remain a major source of pollution. Pesticides are pollution. Pesticides are also a driver of biodiversity loss. Maybe you've heard of the class of chemicals known as neonicotinoids. They are primarily what's responsible for the demise of our pollinators, the bees in particular. And I must make here to the point, this is another important take home, listeners. Pesticide use is expected to rise as the climate crisis worsens and the planet continues to warm. And you might be saying to yourself, well, why on earth would that be true? What does pesticide use and climate change have to do with one another? Well, one reason is that rising soil temperatures, which are a result of a warming planet, rising soil temperatures spur the degradation of pesticides, which decreases the effectiveness of a pesticide and thus means that greater amounts of pesticides will be required to maintain the crop yields that farmers are used to seeing. And so, yes, here in the United States, the EPA in the 70s did take action on DDT. It took a while, but action was taken. However, I do want to mention that here in the United States, our governmental regulating bodies, they are notoriously slow to act. We see this all the time in beauty and personal care products. How many episodes have I done on the lack of regulation in that arena? The same occurs in the pesticides arena. Even on the rare occurrence that a dangerous pesticide is removed from the market, don't forget that even if that happens, which it doesn't happen very often, chemical companies and growers, they just start using other options that may be just as dangerous or more dangerous. Again, it's the same thing that happens in our personal care products all the time. Oh, triclosan is dangerous and the public knows about it? Oh, well, we'll just replace that chemical in our lotion with one that's slightly different. It has a brand new fancy name. The public isn't yet aware of this new chemical that we have this fancy name for. It's perhaps just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than what we're replacing. But hey, let's move on, business as usual. Now, before we move on to part two, I just want to talk about the environmental working groups, Clean 15 and Dirty Dozen. You may have heard of these lists before. The environmental working group does offer these two lists. They are updated every year. And I would recommend and would love it if you today used these lists as a starting point, a starting point. I do not want you to use these lists as so many of us do, which is an end-all be-all, right? We buy conventional pesticide-laden items if they're on the Clean 15 list. However, if the product is on the Dirty Dozen, we buy the organic. That's how so many of us use these lists. And I'm hoping that by the end of today's episode, you are armed with more detailed information because these lists, they're too simple, in my humble opinion. I did certainly use them as resources in my early days as a conscious food shopper. However, there are major discrepancies between the EWG's suggestions and Consumer Reports suggestions. You will hear Dr. Rogers and I talk about the watermelon problem in a moment. Dr. Rogers is going to suggest buying organic local grown watermelons whenever possible. However, according to the EWG, watermelon is on the Clean 15. So major discrepancy there. Dr. Rogers also, you need to stay tuned for this, by the way, but Dr. Rogers also makes a major and for me personally, life-changing recommendation about buying organic items from countries with reciprocity, with organic reciprocity. So that means nothing to you right now, but make sure your ears perk up on that in a couple minutes. It is not as simple as buying these 15 items with pesticides and these 12 items organic. It's just not that simple. The pesticides problem is so much more nuanced And part two of my conversation, the interview portion of today's show, will address the nuance. So one more time for the people in the back, I am not knocking the EWG. I am not knocking the Clean 15 or the Dirty Dozen. These two lists are a great starting point, keyword starting point. But if you're no longer starting out and if you're ready to add to your knowledge base, that's what the interview that's coming up is all about. So if you know better, you get to do a bit better. It's time for our ad break, but when we come back, we'll get into part two of today's pesticides conversation with an interview with Dr. James Rogers, who oversees food safety at Consumer Reports. I'll see you in a minute. Nothing nurtures the world above better than the soil below, and that's why I am so excited to introduce you to Coast of Maine. Coast of Maine is an organic soil brand that offers a full range of products designed to cover all of your garden and lawn needs. In years past, my vegetable garden, I neglected the soil and I didn't have much yield. If your soil lacks appropriate nutrients for success, your garden may not succeed. And so this year, I am so excited to cultivate the soil before planting the plants with Coast of Maine's organic products. Coast of Maine believes in nurturing relationships with local retailers. So next time you're at your local retailer, look for Coast of Maine products. Get growing. Visit coastofmaine.com to find a local retailer near you. coastofmaine.com. If you've been paying attention, you've likely heard something about gut health and why zoning in on your gut health is so darn important. You need EQ's Daily Women's Microbiome Defense. It's a 3-in-1 capsule that supports your digestive health and promotes gut barrier protection. I started taking EQ's Daily Women's Microbiome Defense because I have a bloating problem, friends. Yes, I do. Inflammation is not my friend. Since taking one capsule a day on an empty stomach with water, I have noticed more energy, improved skin, and here's the big one, reduced bloating. Head to myeq.com and use code SUSTAINABLE for 15% off Equilibria's microbiome defense and so much more. That's myeq.com and use code SUSTAINABLE at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. Listeners, I'm going to be 40 next month. Oh my goodness. And even though there's a big part of me that wants to buy into the anti-aging claims of all the products, I am, of course, quite skeptical. I recently just discovered a brand called Lima, and it is changing the game when it comes to caring for your skin. It is science-based. The Lima laser is the most powerful clinic-grade cosmetic laser device, and it's the only laser that's FDA cleared for at-home use. I am so excited to try the Lima laser on my wrinkles, and you know I'll be reporting back. Visit lima.life, that's LYMA.life, and learn more about the Lima laser. If you're interested in trying one, you can sign up for their newsletter. Tell them that Sustainable Minimalists sent you and let me know how it goes for you. That's lyma.life. And we're back, my friends. Before the break, we discussed everything you needed to know about pesticides, just me, you, and pesticides before the break. And now we're on to part two of today's episode, which is a conversation with Dr. James Rogers. Dr. James Rogers has been on the show many a time. He oversees food safety at Consumer Reports. Consumer Reports very recently conducted the most comprehensive review of pesticides in food. Their findings are out in the June issue of the magazine. It's also available online, and it's also linked in this week's show notes. Dr. Rogers, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show yet again. How are you?
I am doing fine, and thank you for the ability to talk to you and your audience again.
Well, thank you for studying food. And thank you for coming on today to discuss the pesticides problem. I know as a consumer, I tend to look at food as either pesticide laden or organic, healthy or not healthy. And I know, thanks to your reporting, that this is an incorrect assumption. There are many different pesticides, and different pesticides come with different risk profiles. So talk to me about that.
So in our report, we pointed out a number of pesticides that this study detected in the testing data that we obtained from the USDA. Some of the major ones that we discussed included acephate and its breakdown product, methylmyophos. This is a pesticide that is actually banned in the United States, has been banned for over 10 years, but is still appearing in our food. We also discussed phosmet, which was an organophosphate pesticide that's been linked to neurodevelopment issues in children that have been exposed to the pesticide. And then oxamil, which is a highly toxic pesticide that was detected in the data set too. I think what your listeners need to understand that for this analysis, there were times that we detected multiple pesticides on fresh fruit or vegetable or a canned fruit or vegetables. And so it's not an individual pesticide issue. At times it could be multiple pesticides just on one type of food.
Let's talk about acephate for a minute. That's the one that the EPA has banned, and yet you found it all over green beans. I believe it was green beans from Mexico, to be more specific. But the EPA has tolerance levels. They've created these tolerance levels. Walk me through the tolerance levels. Like, I'm assuming for a different pesticide, there's a different tolerance level. And then I also want your opinion on them. Are they too high?
The EPA has a specific way that they determine a tolerance level. And a tolerance level is defined as the maximum amount of a particular pesticide that is allowed to remain in or on a fruit or vegetables. And you may, in your reading, see something called a maximum residue limit. Those two terms are sometimes used interchangeably. And what the EPA has done to determine these tolerances is to look at what is the total exposure of the pesticide to the consumer. So not only your food, but also your water and possibly your environment. You may understand that if you were a farm worker and you're in a field where they're using pesticides, you have an environmental exposure to that, including anything you may eat or drink. They also looked at what is the cumulative effects. What does that mean over long term? Pesticides can accumulate and their negative effects to the human body will be felt over time. This is not something that's really acute, that you get one exposure and then you're sick. This is something that is over time and long-term exposure. They also look at subpopulations such as children, pregnant people, the immunocompromised, and then just looking to see if there's anything similar to this pesticide causing like hormones or endocrine disruption or so on and so forth. They would say that they use the best information and the best data at the time of setting a tolerance. However, in our article, we quoted Michael Hansen, who's a senior scientist at Consumer Reports, that has concerns about the EPA tolerance levels set because we believe that they don't use the latest data. They don't use the method to actually determine what the risk is of that pesticide, the most modern ways to calculate that. And so what we did is say, we don't agree with your tolerance level. So we will calculate our own tolerance level that we consider is more health protective. And then we will use that to rank these fruits and vegetables in the very colorful chart on the website and in the magazine to help consumers understand what the actual risk is of these vegetables. And so, yes, we have chosen a lower tolerance level because we believe the science and the medical information supports that.
All right. So even the EPA, which may very likely be offering tolerance levels that are perhaps too high, however, even the EPA has said that the pesticide acephate, which is commonly found on green beans, there's no tolerance level. Acephate has been banned on vegetables for over a decade. And yet,
yes,
in your analysis, you found this banned pesticide, acephate, on green beans. How on earth is that possible?
Well, we were concerned about acephate too and the breakdown product. So a couple of ways that this could happen. Number one, you could still have, even though it's banned, you could still have some farmers using it, but we're hoping that's not the case. You noted the issue with acephate and green beans, for instance. A lot of those green beans could be imported, and there is not necessarily, with every country that we import food from, the same level of scrutiny to make sure these banned pesticides are not being used when they grow the food over there. In our testing, for instance, we reported there were 14 to 500 times the amount of acephate that was above a particular limit. And so that was very alarming to us.
Yes. So I want to just make sure I understand. So here in the United States, we have tolerance levels, regulations, whatever we want to call it, for these chemicals. However, are those tolerance levels only applicable to produce that's grown in the United States? Does produce coming from South America, let's say, can they do whatever their country of origin says is legal?
Let's use the example of organic, if you don't mind. When you look at the organic standard in the United States, it's a very specific standard, and we support the organic label that comes from the USDA because we know that there is scrutiny, there's inspections, there's all types of oversight of how an organic farm has to work. Now, if you want to buy an organic product that's imported, and we say in the article that organic produce tends to have less pesticides, if not any at all, you are relying on that country being part of a reciprocity agreement between the United States and that country. And what that means is that if you enter in this agreement with the United States, you will ensure that your organic label means something. Those countries include the European Union and Canada and Japan, et cetera. If you're not part of that reciprocity agreement, then we as consumers have to rely on some type of inspection or whatever of that organic farm and that organic production. And those inspections are good, but they're expensive. Not everyone does them. And so if I were a consumer and I was concerned about pesticides, I would, number one, try to buy organic. But number two, if I bought produce that was produced overseas, that I would buy it from countries that are within this reciprocity agreement with the United States, because I have more faith that they will be truly producing an organic product to ship over to the United States.
I think I know what you're going to say, Dr. Rogers, but I'm going to ask anyway. A lot of produce in my grocery store comes from Mexico, Central America, and South America. Are any of those countries in this reciprocity agreement?
Let's read the list. So Canada, European Union, Japan, Republic of Korea, Switzerland, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom. And I got those countries from the USDA's website that discusses the equivalence between our organic program and other countries.
There you have it. All right. Thank you.
But I think that what you're noting is that Mexico is really close to us. They can produce a lot of the fruits and vegetables that we want, especially out of season, probably more affordable, but they're not on this list. And so their use of pesticides, their use of the organic label is not as well regulated as we would want it to be.
Right. And I certainly, as a consumer, do not want to be paying $8 per pint of, let's just say, strawberries, organic strawberries, and then to find out that they're not organic at all. All right. So speaking of berries, let's talk about my youngest daughter's absolute favorite fruit, which, of course, is blueberries. Blueberries, conventional non-organic blueberries, do come with the phosmet. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. The phosmet problem. What did you find in your analysis with regard to blueberries and phosmet? And what do you suggest for parents like me who have kids who love blueberries?
So our data revealed that if we look at blueberries, specifically conventional, fresh, and frozen blueberries, as you noted, and you pronounced it correctly, Phosmet, which is an organophosphate pesticide associated with the risk to children for causing neurodevelopmental disorders such as ADHD, memory problems, and motor skill issues, was detected on these blueberries. What we recommend is that for blueberries, you consider eating organic blueberries, either imported or domestic, again, noting what we said about organic labeling, which is a common recommendation, as we said before, of if you really want to avoid pesticides, to eat organic. So that's what I would recommend, that you buy your daughter either organic blueberries, imported or domestic.
What I hear you saying there is that Phosmet has a high risk profile, particularly for children, and I'm guessing also for other sensitive populations, perhaps pregnant women as well.
Yes.
I have that right. Okay.
Yes, you do have it right.
All right. Let's go on to another fruit that your research highlighted. It's coming into its glory days, summer. We got to talk about the watermelons. Yeah. Why are conventional non-organic watermelons concerning from human health perspective?
If you look into the data, the testing data, that testing data revealed that conventional watermelons could be contaminated with the pesticide oxamil. This is a highly toxic pesticide that is linked to nerve damage in consumers. Because of the presence of oxamil, in the article, we recommended that consumers consider organic watermelons or even cantaloupe, because cantaloupe scored lower for the presence and concentrations of pesticides than watermelon did.
I was talking to my husband about the watermelon problem, because I've always been under the assumption, and I think now from reading your reporting, it's an incorrect assumption, but if we are not eating the skin or the rind, I assumed incorrectly again that perhaps that was healthier if we were eating a conventional item. However, nobody eats the rind of a watermelon, and still it has this highly toxic oxamil problem.
You do have that, because some pesticides will get into the soil and be taken up by the plant and become systemic, which means it will go throughout the plant, including the fruit. So it, let's say you tested the rind versus the internal parts, the red part of a watermelon. Because it's systemic, you would be able to detect that pesticide in both places. There are some pesticides and the issues that will stay on the surface. But yeah, that's the reason why, because these pesticides can get to the internal parts of the fruit and contaminate it too.
So oxamil is the pesticide to discuss when it comes to watermelon and bell peppers. So for me personally, I have success growing bell peppers, so I will be growing bell peppers my heart out this summer. I have never grown a successful watermelon, but I will be choosing local and organic watermelons this summer. Let's now talk about potatoes, and I'm going to try to pronounce the pesticide. This is going to be, I'm going to butcher it, but I'm going to try, because, I mean, trying is half the battle. Chlorpropafam.
You got it right. Got it right.
All right, talk to me about chlorpropafam.
So this is another one of those pesticides that, again, can get inside potatoes. And we noted in the article two ways to deal with chlorpropafam and these other pesticides. Number one is to limit your consumption. And if you noticed in the article, we never said stop eating fruits and vegetables or stop eating in some particular fruits and vegetables. But what we did say is look at possible contamination and adjust your consumption. We also suggested try substitution. And so in your example about white potatoes, we suggested that you substitute sweet potatoes for white potatoes, if not every time, on occasion, because we want to lower your exposure to these pesticides. And we also suggested substituting snap peas instead of green beans. I just said cantaloupe instead of watermelon, and cabbage or dark green lettuces instead of kale. So we still want you to get your fruits and vegetables, but we want you to be a little bit more selective.
I'm so happy you mentioned that point, Dr. Rogers, because fruits and vegetables are a staple of a healthy diet, right? And so the answer is not to not eat them and avoid them. The answer is to stay abreast of most recent research and adjust your eating of these very important macronutrients accordingly. And so I'm happy you said that. I have one more pesticide. I'm not even going to try to pronounce this one, but it's with regard to, again, you mentioned kale, mustard greens. I must say, I love kale. I love it. So what should I be aware of?
We indicated that there was an issue with kale and pesticides. And again, that's why we made it one of our substitution stars. It got one of its own columns in the article. And we suggested broccoli, but also try cabbage or dark green lettuces instead of kale because of the issue that we found with that.
So in terms of washing, is there a specific way we should be washing our conventional produce? Do the rinses work? Do the special brushes work? What do you recommend?
So in the article, we did mention that washing your produce can remove some pesticide residues. Again, those that are on the outside, on the peel or the skin or the rind. It's not going to remove everything, and it's certainly not going to remove the pesticides that are on the inside, on the fleshy parts. What we are recommending is that you do a cold water wash for 15 to 20 seconds. Some people do use a brush, and that might help a little bit. But there are no special rinses or washes that science has shown is any more effective than just cold water for 15 to 20 seconds. We also are recommending, and this may not be in the article, but it has come up in discussions, that even pre-washed fruits and vegetables, we believe, should be washed again, because usually they pre-wash them in these huge tubs where you can get cross-contamination. So you could have a batch of kale that wasn't contaminated, and you wash it with a contaminated batch, and then you contaminate everything. So we say wash any of the pre-washed fruits and vegetables too, using the cold water in the 15 to 20 seconds.
So you heard it here first, listeners. You don't need one of those fancy washes. You just need some cold water in 15 to 20 seconds. Let's talk about frozen vegetables, canned vegetables. Nutrients profile aside, how do the canned and the frozen items compare in terms of pesticide prevalence as opposed to their fresh counterparts? Should we be prioritizing the canned and the frozen or not?
So this data set contained both, or all three. It contained fresh, frozen, and canned. And so the findings that we are seeing and reporting on extend across all three versions. According to the data and what we saw in the data, there's really no way to purchase your way away from this problem by purchasing canned versus frozen. So we would say that our findings extend to all versions of however the fruits and vegetables are packaged.
You mentioned, you know, buying your way out of the problem, essentially. However, when it comes to action steps, Consumer Reports does suggest that whenever possible, we do switch to organic versions, again, from those countries with reciprocity. And then also one final action step is to eat lower risk produce. So The article mentions carrots, cabbage, cauliflower, peas. There are many in the article, and I'll link to it in the show notes. I just want to thank you so much for this analysis, reporting our conversation today, because I must say, as somebody who buys fruits and vegetables, I've always just gone into the supermarket and looked organic versus non-organic. But now you've given me some real tangible information. I need to also now look at the country of origin. So I want to thank you so much, Dr. Rogers. You've helped me become a more informed consumer. Thank you.
Oh, you're certainly welcome, and I'm glad to do it. And when the next important story comes out, I look forward to talking to you again.
I know, lucky number four next time. So we're like old friends now, but thank you.
All righty.
Listeners, that's my conversation with Dr. Rogers from Consumer Reports. My final word for us all today is this. It's important to support organic efforts if financially possible. If it's not financially possible for you, if you can't afford organic, no worries. You keep doing you. Do the best you can. I'm not telling you to go into debt to buy organic food. No. However, if you have extra dollars to spend, a couple here, a couple there, buy this organic item once in a while, I do believe that is important. And the reason it's important is because I also believe we deserve to live in a world in which organic food is at the very least an option for us. I was talking to my neighbor about the research that I went through for this episode. And my neighbor said essentially that it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. We're all going to die. And that's certainly true, right? If you get cancer from the pesticides on your blueberries, or perhaps the phosmate on your blueberries interacted with the triclosan that had already accumulated in your body after decades of using body lotion. So those two chemical compounds interacted in your body and resulted in the formation of cancerous cells. That will never be proven. That will never be proven, will it? Nobody's ever going to do that study and come to that conclusion. No one's doing that research even. And the fact that no one's doing that research, it doesn't benefit you and me, humans that are just trying to live healthy, long lives. It benefits the companies and corporations that are using the potentially harmful chemicals. But even if we can never definitively link a pesticide with a negative health effect, we still deserve a market with options. If we don't buy organic, farmers may very likely grow less and less organic until one day all the produce in the grocery store is laden with pesticides. And that is a world I do not want to live in, because I fundamentally believe that we consumers, at the very least, the bottom, the foundation, we deserve a lot, but at the very least, we deserve options. So if you can support organic efforts, yes, for your own health, for your children's health, yes, for health of the planet, yes, but also for diversity in the marketplace. Vote with your dollars. All right. Whew, I'm getting fired up. If you liked the show and you learned something, please rate it. Please review it. Thank you so much. Please consider continuing to support with $5 a month. This show takes up an awful lot of time. It's my job. And if it's not making money, I have to quit the show and go get a regular job. And I really don't want to do that. So if you get benefit from my hard work, if my hard work makes you do things differently, think about the world differently, please consider supporting the work. Thank you so much. We will be back tomorrow for headlines. This show's really long, so I'm going to wrap it up, say I appreciate you. Thanks for tuning in, and see you tomorrow.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand, and he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.